The surrender did not come as a great shock to Bank, but he was outraged by the prevailing circumstances in Washington that had made surrender inevitable. "I was extremely bitter when I began the march," he recalled. "Where was America? Why had we been left out here like this? Why had we not been more prepared? I felt I was witnessing one of the greatest failures in our history." All through the march, Bank attempted to figure out what the patterns and rules were, or even if there were any. The Japanese guards were often arbitrary. Bank couldn't predict how they would react. Each one had different peeves, applied different standards, demanded different levels of civility. What incensed one might go unnoticed by another. An infraction that in the morning could provoke a grisly beating might only draw inscrutable smiles in the afternoon. The violence came in random gusts. Not entirely random, however. Gradually, a few tendencies seemed to suggest themselves. One had to do with stature. Big guys, Bank noticed, generally came in for more punishment. Bank, who was fortunate enough to be a slight-statured, fine-boned man, heard this observation widely discussed among the prisoners. Many of the guards had evidently never encountered Westerners before, and some clearly derived a perverse pleasure from physically dominating the tallest among the prisoners. At the very least, large men visually stood out from the crowd and presented a more obvious target for a guard's wrath. Another general rule that impressed itself upon Bank concerned the searches to which prisoners were repeatedly subjected. Prudence dictated that an American prisoner carefully study all belongings on his person and discard anything that displayed, even microscopically, the words "Made in Japan." The guards automatically assumed that these items were stolen off the corpses of Japanese soldiers. It was true that during the siege of Bataan, Americans on the front lines had routinely taken souvenirs from dead Japanese troops, rising sun flags, photographs, the ornate thousand-stitch belts that had been sewn by female well-wishers back in Japan. But the Japanese guards on the march made no distinction between such war booty and, say, a small Japanese-made mirror that an American enlisted man might have purchased in a Manila department store before the war. Many Americans were thus beaten, and some were even executed, for possessing innocuous objects which, upon closer scrutiny, bore the signature of having been manufactured in Dai Nippon. Bank also became aware of the benefits of constantly shielding himself with other bodies. You always wanted to keep away from the guards as much as possible, and never give them an opportunity to hit you, he said. The Japanese usually marched the prisoners four abreast in segmented columns of as many as 100 men. Trouble almost always seemed to come to those who walked along the outside edges. These perimeter marchers were more directly exposed to the ire of Japanese guards, as well as to the gratuitous bashings and potshots sometimes taken by Imperial Army troops who happened to pass by. Since everyone quickly grasped this trend, jockeying for a choice vacancy became a competitive enterprise. If at all possible, said Bank, you wanted an inside slot. If someone in the middle dropped out, everybody would simultaneously rush for the empty spot. Truly, a marcher's position could be a matter of life or death. On one memorable occasion, an American prisoner was marching on the outside when he began to falter. He was obviously lurching, straying a few feet out from the main group, when a convoy of Japanese tanks happened to approach from the rear. The first tank operator deliberately swerved to run over him, and the other tanks in the convoy followed suit, so that the American's body was squashed into the road like a free-fallen cartoon villain, his clothes pressed flat into the asphalt.